Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Leanne Carnegie. Leanne Carnegie grew up in Eastern Ontario. She had her first close encounter with at least one Sasquatch in 1988 while sleeping in a tent in the woods. Her second encounter happened in 2012 while berry picking alone deep in cottage country wilderness. This event was the ultimate paradigm shift that would change her life forever. She has spent the last 7 years pursuing the truth of Sasquatch in various locations in southern Ontario. She has found very clear and defined footprints in 8 different areas and has listened to hundreds of hours of their evening activity that she has recorded on audio. Her real passion is in the discovery and documentation of stick structures. For over 3 years, Leanne has felt emotionally and telepathically guided toward the finding of many of these beautiful and complicated structures. She feels that the visual awareness of these creations can act as a tool for spiritual awakening and has the ability to deepen our connection to the earth, to wildlife, and most importantly, to each other. She believes that these ancient forest people are here to help awaken us to the truth of their existence and to our collective history. And we will have links to Leanne's dedicated YouTube channel, Southern Ontario Sasquatch, on the Cosmic Switchboard website, as well as our dedicated YouTube channel. So without any further ado, Leanne Carnegie, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thanks so much for having me, James. It's truly a pleasure to be here.
Well, the pleasure is all ours, Leanne. What we found over time is the understanding of whatever subject, whatever topic expands over time. And there are forces at work that try to keep it limited, try to keep it on a very basic, even anthropological level in the case of Sasquatch research. But what I really appreciate about what you, Leanne Carnegie, as well as Mike Patterson have done is you've pushed the bounds of research out there and you've said, look, for some of these Sasquatch, some tribes of them, they're not all alike, but for some of them, there definitely is this metaphysical, spiritual, interdimensional aspect, even a connection to ETs. So we're going to get into all of that. For now, Leanne, please tell our listeners about yourself and about your voyage of discovery. How did you wind up doing this critically important work?
Well, as mentioned in my little brief bio at the start, I think I became open to the subject. Well, I know I did. Back in 1988, when I had one, possibly two, running around my campsite and my tent, it was an extraordinary experience and one that really shook me to my core. I was in an area where there was no bears, and I originally had thought it was the largest member of our group running around in the pitch black in the middle of the night with no flashlight chasing something much smaller. And when I poked my head out of the tent and realized there's no flashlight, no fire, no nothing, and realized that this is not one of my friends, and you know, it caused me to question, well, what is this? And the terror, the fear that I felt that one night really shook me to my core. This massive creature kept running around throughout our campsite. It made the ground shake. It was bipedal. It had the deepest, huffiest gruffs and grunts. And whatever it was chasing, it sounded like a high-pitched squealing noise. And I kept wondering, what on earth is that? And if you are so big to make the ground shake as you're walking, kind of half running around and past our tent, why can't you just get this creature? And the reason why I suspect it may have been another smaller Sasquatch, and maybe it was a lesson and they were just messing with me, is because I've since recorded the same bipedal footsteps chasing something small that's been squeaking just like what I heard back in 88. And I only learned that and picked that up in audio 2 years ago. And it made me realize that that one loose end of that strange experience back in that campsite may now have been completed. And they may have just taught me that it may have been two of them running around and scaring the living daylights out of me, and which initially woke me up to the possibility of the subject.
Were any other members of your camping crew awakened, and did they likewise notice all the activity?
No, they did not, and that's part of the story. I tried so hard to wake up my tent mates. I pinched them, I shook them, I spoke their names in their ears. I was so afraid to make any noise, and they were completely unconscious. And I had to double, triple check to make sure that this wasn't a dream. I pinched the backs of my hands on top of my knuckles. I pinched in between my eyes so hard that it left a mark there for at least another day or two after. And I was fully conscious. And it's like I was in a twilight zone experiencing this tremendous terror and fear that I never knew was possible to feel. No, nobody else heard it. And once these footsteps and this chasing action stopped around our tent, and I listened to them disappear off into the woods, I instantly fell asleep. And so I don't know if I passed out due to shock myself or whether I was subject of infrasound. There may have been some mind control going on with that. But it was an extraordinary experience. And I didn't talk about that to anyone for a long time. I told one woman the next day who was the senior counselor of the camp, and she showed a bit of interest. And we actually went and looked for prints. She was open enough to ask me to show her where I heard them run off. And we didn't find any because there had been a little bit of rain early in the morning. But I never forgot that. And it in that instant, I knew that I'd come in contact or almost contact with something that is real, something that exists. There was no doubt in my heart, my soul, my mind that what I experienced that night and the level of fear and trauma that it caused me for a long time after was real.
Whereabouts was this campsite?
It was between Kingston and Ottawa here in Southern Ontario. So near a place called Westport.
And I take it it's quite forested?
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And it's actually right next to a provincial park. That's a massive, very large wilderness protected forest.
In the days following this initial encounter, did you have any interesting dreams or was your sleep disrupted? Or how were you on a day-to-day, normal, conscious awakening basis?
I think I put it away. I think I didn't think about it for a long time. And I always knew it was in there, but because I hadn't really spoken about it to anybody, I just let it rest. But what's interesting is back in about 2005, I was listening to a radio program on the Jeff Rentz program, and he had somebody on there who was talking about his own Sasquatch experiences, and he became a bit of an investigator in the northeast part of the States, and I can't remember his name. And listening to that interview, it inspired me to finally write up that story once and for all, to get it out. So I grabbed my laptop and I wrote everything down. It was like a purge. I felt all the feelings over again. My palms were sweaty. My heart was racing. It was a very emotional process to go through, which I think I needed. And I wrote it not just for myself, but I had chosen to finally submit it somewhere, to some organization, to some group of people to read it, to contribute my experience. And wouldn't you know it, the craziest thing happened, which was the moment I finished, my laptop ran out of batteries. It hadn't been plugged in. And I had been using a program that didn't auto save. And I went back, like this is just this old dinosaur of a computer, of a laptop. And I went back once it was turned on and I couldn't find it. So I'd lost it.
Oh, that's painful.
Oh my gosh, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it because it had been so perfect and so powerful and so passionately written. It just came right out. So I was so bummed by that I didn't try it again. I didn't even bother. It really was hard. But anyway, I resurrected that story once I had my berry picking incident, which happened back in 2012. And that story is such that we have a family property up near Ottawa that my parents purchased a long time ago. And something I've always loved doing is picking blueberries and raspberries and blackberries in different areas of this forest. And this one particular summer, I was back there by myself, and the blackberries were really amazing. It was an awesome season. They were so big and so bountiful. And I was about a kilometer away from my car, up and over a hill. There was no cottage, nothing anywhere around. If you'd screamed, nobody would have heard you. And I was happily back there picking blackberries, and I found this really thick and tall shrub. The blackberries had grown in and over a bunch of other bushes, as they do with their vines. And so I had started on the outside of this big blackberry shrub wall, really, and the side of the woods and the edge of the woods. And I squeezed myself farther and farther in to the shrub, deeper and deeper. And I was so happy. I had to be so careful with all the prickles. It was a hot, sunny afternoon, around 3:30 in the afternoon. The sun was kind of facing me through the trees, if that makes any sense. So I was facing like southwest kind of thing. And after being in this shrub for, I would say, at least 10 minutes, and I was pretty close to the tree line, getting quite close to the back, I heard this really deep and close rah, that sounded like it was just feet away. And I estimate it probably came from about 10 to 15 feet away from me. And at the same time, I heard this huge grunt, growl, exhale, because the blackberries sometimes grow in these vines, like they have these tendrils that reach out. And this one bush was like one big wall. The entire bush shook as I was in it, and I saw the Sasquatch step out from the back of it into the, like right on the edge of the forest, kind of almost like in the forest. And I saw it turn, saw the profile, saw the darkness, because the sun was coming from kind of behind it to the left a little, from the left a little bit. And it turned and bipedally walked away. And I heard it and I saw it, and it was so close. There hadn't been any wind. It was a hot, sunny day. I'd been in there and I hadn't heard anything approach this blackberry bush. I hadn't heard anything walking through the forest. Whenever I'm out in the woods, especially berry picking, all my senses are turned on full blast, because I'm aware there are bears. I know that there's even cougars up in this area. So I'm very tuned into the noises around me, and I hadn't heard anything. And so when this happened, I turned and ran. I dropped my berries, I remember, and I ran all the way back to the car. And it shook me for days and days and days and weeks and months. It took me a long time to process. Again, I'll use the word trauma, but that's what it was, the fear and the powerful emotion that I felt in that very moment. And something else that's really interesting that I haven't really spoken a lot about, but in that moment of realizing that there was a Sasquatch right there on the other side of, like, just on the edge of this big shrub, I was hit with the most powerful out-of-body experience that I think I've ever had. It may have been from, I may have been hit by infrasound, it may have been my own shock, but I had the sensation of instantaneously, so quickly, in a nanosecond, my consciousness spinning out from the top of my head like a spiral, and then it came back into my head. And I don't know what other words to use to describe that feeling, but in that moment of seeing this and hearing this and realizing this, I spun out of the top of my head, I spun back in, and I was running out down the path. It was done. So it literally put me out of my body for that moment. I'm sure maybe that's just my own fight or flight, right?
We've heard similar things in the UFO ET field, where some ETs have this ability to intentionally engender out-of-body experiences, astral experiences in people sleeping or otherwise. So it also may be, Leanne, an innate ability you have. You may have this ability to astral travel. Now, leading up to that point, now I got a few more questions about the experience itself. Was there anything in your background up to that point that turned out later to be of great benefit to you? Whether it was something, some course of studies you did in school, or maybe you've always had a metaphysical, spiritual bent on things. Was there anything that kind of grounded you or prepared you for the work you're doing?
Yeah, I would say my whole life I've experienced many metaphysical types of experiences. When I was a child, I used to have my mother, I would call her my mother, she's not my real mother, but this bright light would come out of my closet in the middle of the night. And this is when I was tiny, tiny. And I would be bathed in this incredibly powerful white light. And I would talk to the light telepathically. And I knew this light as my mother. And this is long, I mean, I'm talking when I'm 2-3 years old, I've got this memory for. And this light would give me so much love and so much peace and so much protection. I felt that this mother light was there to protect me and be with me. And because I was so young, I didn't know any different. This happened frequently, and I never talked about it with anybody. I didn't have the language for that. I would also say that I had lots of reoccurring dreams as a young girl. Dreams of visiting and revisiting the same worlds that don't seem to exist on this earth anymore. And when I traveled to these worlds in my dreams, I would remember the streets, the street names, the buildings, the people there. I would know their names. And every time I went back, and there was a few different places, I can still visualize them perfectly in my mind's eye. Every time I went there, I was so excited. I couldn't wait to get home. I couldn't wait to be back with all these people who I love and care for so much. And it wasn't like a dream. It was like just a visit. And I would wake up, and pretty much, I'm sure, well, I don't know how many times I haven't remembered, but every time I remembered going there, it left me with such a deeply contented and connected feeling that, all right, I was just with the people who I love and who I know in these worlds that are my home, like my real home, where I know the mountains, I know the rivers, I hike and climb and do all these incredible things out in nature and navigate these credulous cities, beautiful, and feel so at peace. So I would say that's something else. I also had a really incredible UFO experience when I was 16, somewhere between grade 9 and grade 10. And this also happened at our summer property where I later had the Sasquatch sighting while berry picking. I had a girlfriend up at the cottage. It was in August. It was past mosquito season. And my girlfriend and I were up on the roof of our cottage. And ever since being about 12 years old, I was fascinated with astronomy, and I taught myself all the constellations and all the stars and where they are. And one of my favorite things to do was to lie in a boat at night on a lake and just watch the stars. And I was so proud that I could identify them and talk about them. So I was up there with her with the binoculars, and I was showing her the constellations. And my parents were up there with two other couples, and they were just doing the adult thing in the cottage. Well, at around 10 o'clock, I'd say, and I remember that quite specifically, I saw across the lake this red light that had been stationary, and then it began to zigzag back and forth, like up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down to the right, and then back to the left, zigzagging back to the right, and then it disappeared below the horizon. And I thought, gosh, that's so weird. There's no clouds, no cloud cover. Closest city is about 2 hours away. And then it popped up above the horizon again. And I said to my friend, oh my gosh, I think that we're looking at a UFO. I have no idea what that is. It's not making any sound. there's no houses over there. It's crown land for a long, long way, the odd cottage, and that's it. And so I was so excited. I got up and I jumped off the corner of the roof. It was only maybe a 6.5 foot drop. But I normally didn't do that because there's some rocks below, but I was so excited. I'm like, I couldn't wait to go tell the adults inside. Jumped off. I kind of scraped myself up. Didn't matter. I was full of adrenaline. And I went in and I said, you got to come out, got to come out, got to look at this light across the lake. And they came. And the moment they came out, I swear, it was just like a scene from a movie. It disappeared below the horizon. And I thought, ah, darn it. And of course, they said, it was just a weather balloon or, just a flashlight, whatever. No problem. They went to bed. It was around 10 o'clock. And they said, you should go to bed too. Well, the one friend that my parents had there at the time was an elementary school principal. And he was also a retired Canadian Air Force pilot. So we're talking about a man who is has a strong head on his shoulder with, I would say, sound judgment and a lot of life experience, especially from the Air Force. And he said, Leanne, can you show me where you saw the light? And so we went down to the dock, the three of us, me and my friend and him. And he said, I'd like to kind of stay up and look for it some more. I said, great, I'll stay up with you. And so the three of us sat on the dock and watched the horizon for I don't know how long. Didn't seem that long. And as we were watching, so this summer night was so still, there wasn't any wind. As you, I'm sure, know, sound across lakes travels so quickly. So sometimes we can hear people putting away their dishes across the lake. It's about a mile across, but there's some cottages closer. You can hear them slam their car door sometimes. So it was one of those still summer nights. Sky was perfectly clear. Stars were numerous. And we didn't realize that because we were staring so far across the lake, we saw this massive reflection in the water to our right. So we looked to our right to the south end of the lake, and wouldn't you know it, there was this massive craft moving so slowly, floating just not too far above the horizon towards the direction of where we had seen the first red light. And I would say, because I've written this story up, it was probably the size of a 50-cent piece, maybe a bit bigger, maybe the size of a small black plum. So to give some, when looking at a horizon, that's something quite large. And this craft was shaped, it's funny, at the time I said it's kind of shaped like a Big Mac. So it was shaped like a Big Mac. It wasn't fully round, but it had kind of a rounded top and a rounded bottom, but the sides were, it seemed like they were a bit more straight up and down. And this craft was covered with dozens of lights, colored lights. Most of them were red, but there were also some white lights and some green lights, individual lights. And the three of us sat there watching it. We had one pair of binoculars. We took turns watching it. We got to see it so close up. And we watched it glide across the lake completely silently. It maybe took, 5 minutes or more. And then it disappeared over the horizon where we had originally seen the light from the rooftop. Then we realized there's a second one moving just as slowly, just as close, just as colorful, all those lights. Then we saw a third one. We saw a fourth one. I don't even know how many we saw. I think there may have been some mind control going on, and I'll explain in a second. The three of us saw these. We took turns, the binoculars. And once these big ones had passed, there were two smaller ones that came by, and they were shaped more like a cheeseburger, okay? So narrower and slimmer, okay? Just like a thin cheeseburger. But this craft was different in that it flashed. It was moving faster, first of all, maybe 2-3 times the speed. And instead of having individual lights, the entire craft glowed like this olive green glow. So it would flash, and then the flash would go down, and then it would flash, and then the flash would go down, and it would flash, and then the flash would go down. And in between the flashes, we had the binoculars on it, we could see clear metallic looking surface, just like the classic, Mulder UFO that he's got his on his poster, you know, right? From X-Files, like just your typical. I can't remember if there was a small little thing sticking out on the top, like a little bit of a, like a roof hood on it, but it, you could clearly see the metallic shiny surface of it in between the flashes. And instead of going all the way across the lake where the others had disappeared, it stopped about halfway and then it flashed. It stood there or hovered there, still flashing. And then it just took off pretty much right in line with our eyes until it just disappeared into space. So there was two of those that we saw. So the three of us are watching this like no big deal. We're passing around the binoculars. And we decide to go to bed. Okay, so we have just witnessed the most incredible UFO encounter ever in my experience and certainly Walt's. And we just look at each other and we say, okay, good night, good night. And we go back into the cottage and it's 4:30 in the morning. So we had had 6.5 hours sitting watching these things. Now, I would say to you, it felt like maybe two. It seemed to happen really quickly once things got started. And I don't know where all that time went. And we didn't talk about it when we were sitting there. We weren't oohing and aahing. And it was a mind-blowing experience, but it didn't have the shocking, earth-shattering, soul-shattering trauma that maybe some people experience when they have their paradigm shifting before their eyes. We just sat there and passed around the binoculars. And at no time did we think to A, go get my parents or the other people. B, we never thought to go get a camera in the cottage. And then we just said goodnight and as if no big deal. We woke up a few hours later and we talked about it over the breakfast table. And my dad's friend said, you know, Leanne, he never, ever in his entire life or entire career has ever seen anything like that ever with all of his time in the Air Force. And he doesn't even know how to process it. I remember him saying that he's going to have to think about this for a long time to figure out what we had just seen. And so that's where I left it. Now, my friend who was with me, it terrified her. The next day, I think she was really shocked by it all. And she never talked about it again. She was, you know, classic textbook that we know when people experience something like this, they are so reluctant to talk about it. They're afraid. They want to deny that it happened. And so even though I tried bringing it up with her years after just to help process it, she didn't want to talk about it. So and in fact, I reached out to her through email about 10 years ago, asking her still if she'd like to talk about it, and I never heard back from her. The other gentleman, the retired now school principal, he still brings it up with my parents when they see each other. So that's how significant it was.
Well, the fact that you were all somewhat subdued during the experience, and then afterwards it was just a simple good night, see you in the morning kind of.
I know, it's crazy. It really is something.
Did you ever have dreams about that particular experience again in the years to come?
Yes. I had a dream happen to me a couple of times where, and they were quite scary actually, where I was sleeping in the cabin and I had the white light come down and shine on the cabin and some beings come out of that white light and scare me. And somehow in one particular dream, I was outside the cabin and even though they didn't hurt me, they had called me out and definitely had come from the sky, from a craft. Now, I don't know if that was a real experience, a message, whether that was something my own mind created while it was processing the shock of everything and that paradigm shift unto itself. But as a child, it's funny, I used to sleep in the cabin since being a very young girl. And I used to have a fear of, do you remember the old Hamburglar character from McDonald's? Funny, things keep coming back to McDonald's. But
yes,
the Hamburglar.
Yes, the guy with the black bandit thing.
Black bandit, right?
Yeah.
And So when my parents put me to bed by myself in the cabin as a kid, I was terrified of looking at the windows because I didn't want to see the Hamburglar looking in. And I didn't put that together until recently, but maybe I had had experiences there as a young child that I don't remember. And my way of processing it was associating it with that one particular character. But I can tell you, it did, that experience with UFOs did shock me. And it took some time to be comfortable to talk about that. But nowhere was it in the same ballpark as my berry picking incident. Not at all. It was a really beautiful, enlightening experience, and one that I really cherish sharing with people. I don't talk about it very often. Whereas the Sasquatch, that took months and months for me to process that fear.
Well, thank you for sharing both. Before we segue back to the Sasquatch research and you know, your findings about them, I'd like to ask you again about the recurring dreams that you had about these people, the civilization, the architecture, and what have you. People oftentimes, depending on their DNA profile and you know who they really are, they sometimes quite frequently go dimension hopping when they go to sleep. Other people simply dream, and whereas others go dimension hopping and they go from one reality to another. It sounds like you feel you really had a familial connection with the peoples you would see in these other worlds. And did these people, for the most part, look human?
They do.
And the architecture, would you describe it more as kind of rounded, or did it have the sharp edges and architecture that we were familiar with today? Or did it have more of like a homogeneous kind of aspect to it where it looked more natural?
There's a few different styles. One style, I would say, it reminds me of some paintings I've seen in the British Museum or the National Gallery in London. And I forget the painters' names, but they painted ancient Constantinople, just these magnificent stone cityscapes where, what is it, the Romano, Roman classical style architecture, arches, pillars, beautiful, massive ports, and city centers, domes, spires. The light there reminds me of a Turner painting, just bright and blended and golden, and the air almost seems like it's from a Turner painting like that. The air just seems thicker, more energized, more like there's more moisture in it or something. So that's one place. It makes me wonder if it is like an old Constantinople or a city that, you know, has experienced, a lot of, war. But then there's this other world that I go to that is more medieval, but in that the buildings are more wood, built with wood, and I would say wattle and daub. But I get the feeling it's just as old, and it's the way that the buildings are blended into the landscape, blended into the ground, blended in and around rivers and streams, blended along the coastline. I wouldn't say hobbit-like, but there's an earthy texture to these cities that is beautiful. The bridges aren't necessarily stone, but they're wooden. I don't know if it's something like at a Return of the Jedi, or I mean, not up in the trees like that or anything, but there's just a quality that is just very different. And then there's another world I go to, I can see it perfectly, where I go hiking in the mountains, and there's a small town at the very bottom, and the whole buildings are made of stone. Again, a very old feeling, and I go there and I know all the trails up and down and around. I just can't wait to get into the mountains. My heart is so at peace and it feels such deep joy when I'm there. So those are three that come to mind.
Well, we are the sum of all of our parts, and the fact that a part of you or counterparts of you, if you will, coexist in these other worlds, they're just as real as this one. whether they're in our linear past or whatever the case may be, they're just another frequency away, as you can tell when you go to these places at night. Mm. So, and it segues into the Sasquatch research, because my feeling is at least some of the Sasquatch tribes had an awareness of you before you had an awareness of them. Now, when you started doing the Sasquatch research, you know, looking back in hindsight, that you were guided to certain people, places, and things, did it seem at times like your Sasquatch investigative career was kind of orchestrated, if you will?
I do. I've talked a lot about this with Mike Patterson, actually. I think the experience as a teenager around my tent was the event to open me up to deeply knowing in my heart that they're there. But I don't think I was ready to physically act on that at that age and at that stage in my life. I think my berry picking incident was, I think because of all the other experiences that I'd been having, like the UFOs and there are other things that happen in university, I think every little piece allowed me to have the strength to have the berry picking encounter, endure it, get through it, and come at the other end in order to pursue this journey of learning and discovering and sharing and understanding. It was like I got a nudge over the ledge. Okay, I've been walking on that edge of being a real truth seeker, and I'd spent my whole life reading alternative news. And I don't like the word conspiracies, but, you know, just lots of different authors and people. One of my favorite being Andy Thomas. Are you familiar with Andy Thomas from England? He opened me up to crop circles back in the mid-90s. We became very close friends. And he got me into lots of subjects that I think prepared me for where I am right now. So, yeah, I do think that the berry picking incident was a gift. I think it was a nudge. And although it took a while to get back on my feet, I believe that I'm meant to be here. I believe that I'm meant to be doing what I'm doing, which is finding these incredible structures and sharing their beauty with others. So, yeah.
You talked also about the nocturnal activity of the Sasquatch that you've been around. Mm-hmm. What seems to happen? And obviously for security reasons, without giving the game away, generally, you operate and you work in southern Ontario, a very forested place. Is it mountainous? Are there lots of streams and rivers and lakes there?
There's lots of water. There's no mountains. There's lots of good farmland. And we also have a large part of the province, which is called the Canadian Shield, which is exposed Precambrian bedrock. And that's where our thousands of freshwater lakes are, and it's known as cottage country as well. So there's not necessarily any farming through there, but this is where our great wilderness is. So Mike Patterson got me into audio. So just going back to, you know, people and places and where I found, how I found myself here. I had been, after my berry picking incident, I reached out to some people here in Ontario to help me understand what happened. They were interested with my story. And I began volunteering my time, actually doing some interviews with other people near where I live who claimed to have had sightings. And so I did a few. I wrote up some of their reports and I sent it into the central organization here in Ontario. And that helped me so much in that I was meeting other people who had had a similar traumatic experience who were trying to put the pieces back together. And I think I was helpful to them because they could see that normal people have these experiences, and it takes a long time to talk about them, to process them, and to be at peace with them. So I did that for a couple of years. And that also took me into new areas that I'd never explored before. And this is where I found Mike Patterson, because he had also was a contact of similar contacts in this organization. And he was posting a few notes in this forum. And I reached out to him after watching his video on Sasquatch Speaks. And I reached out to him and I just said, "Hey, Mike, this is who I am. And I live in Southern Ontario and I love your work. And, you know, maybe we can chat sometime. And so that was the beginning of a friendship that we still, you know, still have very closely. So that was almost 4 years ago. I reached out to him and we became friends. And so he helped me remember some other experiences that I had had that I didn't understand at the time what they were. I soon discovered that my passion for the subject was changing. I was no longer yearning to tell my story, but I was yearning to get out and pursue this subject firsthand, if that makes any sense. So Mike encouraged me to start doing audio, which he had been doing for years, and capturing incredible vocals from Nefertia and family up in his location. And so he helped me, he guided me to choose the recorder, and then just gave me a few tips, you know, just love of finding beauty in nature and capturing that on film. And so I was taking myself out more and more with my camera. And as I was doing this, I started stumbling upon these stick formations. And I couldn't believe that I was finding these here. I mean, I knew where Mike found his, but I didn't think that they would, you know, be in more, you know, in lots of other places. But I kept finding them and I kept taking pictures, and I finally shared a couple with Mike. And he's like, "Lee, that looks like the real thing." And we got together and I took him to a few, and he was like, "Yeah, Leanne, I think you're onto them." So it was at that point I started doing audio, and I began leaving my recorder at these structures. And in fact, I'd noticed that these structures had just recently been built, because I'd been going through there with my camera and they hadn't been there. There were two of them close together, and that's where I began doing audio. And I didn't know what I was looking for, but I was so passionately interested and engaged in connecting and relating to Sasquatch through audio, as Mike had recommended. I used trail cameras years before up at my cottage. The summer after I had my berry picking incident, I had a couple up there, and they were taken off the trees. One of the straps was ripped, and there may be something electromagnetically or energetically from the cameras itself that Sasquatch don't like. But anyway, I began doing audio near these two structures that I saw show up, and and I was really bitten by the, I don't know what the phrase is. I was really smitten with the passion of the idea. I was just hook, lined, and sinkered into this. And right off the hop, I noticed that they were coming by the recorder. I was getting bipedal footsteps. I was getting recorder flicks where they take their finger, or I don't know, maybe it's an energy womp on it. They break sticks right next to it, snap little twigs. They'll produce larger wood knocks, boom, right off a tree near the recorder. I've had about three or four trees pushed down right next to the recorder. I've heard them mimicking. They'll go sounding like a raccoon, and then they'll finish with a really deep grunt that is them telling you that this is them and that they can produce all of these different sounds. I've heard them sounding suspiciously like a great horned owl and a barred owl, and like canines, wild canines as well. So I don't mean to be jumping ahead here, but I guess my point is, once I began audio in these, in actually a couple different locations up near my berry picking incident as well, things just began to happen. And I began recording these incredible sounds and making files and putting them, you know, in some sort of order. I think the big kicker happened, or mind blower, again, another paradigm shift happened when I was in Michigan that first summer of doing audio. We visited a friend's cabin right along the beach, and it was right next to a big wooded area. And driving in there, I was seeing all sorts of stick signs, like big X's and some leans against trees. And so I decided to put my recorder out that night. And the very first night I had, and there's no bears in this area, we're too far south according to the maps for bears, these really heavy bipedal footsteps walk directly to my recorder, like from out of the woods, boom, right there. And that sounds like, well, it picks up the recorder and it sounds like it's rubbing its fur with it over and over and over and over again. I envision it almost like it's pretending it's the razor on its face or something like that. I have over 4 minutes of it being rubbed on its body, and then halfway through it stops, and you can actually hear the slight tap of a nail on the buttons on the recorder, and it increases the input level of the recorder, and then keeps rubbing it, and then drops it, and then you can hear the bifetal footsteps walk away. I've made a video of that. That's on my YouTube channel. And I went there the next morning, and all over my windscreen was this really thick mucusy slime, like it had come from a nose or an eye or a mouth. Who knows? It was just filthy, soaking wet. And I looked for hair. You know, me being at the stage in time, I didn't think I recorded anything. I figured it was a dog or something. So I literally just grabbed the recorder and threw it on the floor of my car. And I drove into town to get coffee for everybody, not even thinking that what I had on there was possible, you know, nose mucus from a Sasquatch. So it was later that morning, I was listening to audio, and I heard this, and I thought, oh my gosh, it's still in my car. So I went and grabbed the I brought it in. It was just sitting on the dresser. Oh my gosh, I heard it, and I took my recorder, took the windscreen off, put it in a Ziploc bag, and that's where it still is. It's all dried up, but I'm sure it's contaminated. But it was just the most remarkable thing, and I reached out to Mike right away, and it blew my mind that, boom, they were on it. So that was a really cool thing that happened. And it's funny, I'd been talking with Mike before going to Michigan, and we were saying, I wonder if the Sasquatch know you're going. Because we've talked about the idea of, are they all connected to each other? And I think it's possible that they can all telepathically tap into each other or tune into each other like a grid, like they're all on the same, you know, wavelength, or they're capable of telepathically coming in and out with each other, no matter where they are. And so we were discussing, you know, I wonder if maybe we can ask them, the ones that we're interacting with here, to tell the ones in Michigan that you're coming. And so we joke, ha ha ha, wouldn't that be funny? Well, boom, the first night they were there. And so we talked about that idea, you know, is that possible? Or are they just curious when electronics are put out into their home? Who knows?
I do believe that they have this telepathic ability to communicate over vast distances. We've heard similar stories from people who've lived amongst the natives of Australia, the so-called Aborigines. Of course, they have particular names for each tribe. There's a similar dynamic where pre the influx of people from the United Kingdom here, and probably to this day, when an emissary or a traveler from one tribe is going into the territory of the other, they may carry some object that grants them free passage, unmolested passage. The emissaries or the travelers and the people they've left behind are sending these telepathic messages out. Look, we got a guy going through your area. He's on a peaceful mission. He's doing it for some specific purpose. And all the tribes along the way seem to get the message somehow. In the classic book, Mutant Message from Down Under, the gal, I can't remember if she was an American or an English gal, that was spending this time with this Aboriginal tribe in the outback, she was told by the Aborigines she was with that we're getting a message, a telepathic message. They found the kangaroo, and they're bringing it back, you know, as that night's feast. And they're asking permission if they can cut the tail off because it's too heavy. And we've said, go ahead, do that, and we'll dig a pit and get the, you know, preparations ready for a cookout tonight, right? Sure enough, sometime later, this hunting party comes back with a large kangaroo without a tail. They already had the fire going. And so definitely there's something to this. And so thank you for sharing that. Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment with our guest, Leanne Carnegie. And Leanne, if there are people in Canada or the U.S. that would like to share their stories with you, do you have an email for them if they wanted to contact you?
Yes, absolutely. It is sasquatchresearch@mail.com. sasquatchresearch@mail.com.
And you've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. This is James Bartley. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up, and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the members segment.